Welcome to Polling Matters. My name is Kieran Pedley. Today the podcast revisits the subject discussed in our very first episode, Ed Miliband, the man who, of course, could be the next Prime Minister in a matter of weeks. It is perhaps quite difficult at this stage to assess the success of Ed Miliband's leadership of the Labour Party. On the one hand, his personal poll ratings are very poor, and the public regularly tell pollsters they just can't see him as Prime Minister. On the other hand, he's still here, and despite talk of a Conservative surge in the polls, as the election nears, Labour continue to be neck and neck in the opinion polls, or even slightly ahead of the Tories, which, as we all know, means that Ed Miliband would be favourite to form a government in that situation. So how can we make sense of this apparent contradiction? Is Ed Miliband destined to lose because of his poor poll ratings amongst the public? Is he just simply lucky and destined to win despite his flaws? Or is he actually quite underrated, unfairly cited this week despite a very effective job at uniting the Labour Party, bringing them within a sort of hair's breadth of getting back into government after just one term in opposition? To discuss all of this, I have Professor Tim Bale, who has recently penned the book The Five-Year Mission, The Labour Party Under Ed Miliband. Tim, welcome to Polling Matters.
Hello.
So, Tim, let's start with the book, I guess. Maybe what prompted you to write it is a little bit hokey, but, you know, what did prompt you to write the book? And if there is a central message, what would you say it is?
Well, I guess what prompted me to write the book is I am obsessed with political parties, and I'm lucky enough to be paid to indulge my obsession. And I'm particularly interested in opposition parties and how parties which lose power actually reorganise themselves, reorient themselves ideologically and in terms of policy in order to put themselves in the best position to win, or not, as the case may be. And I wrote a book about the Conservatives, the Conservative Party from Thatcher to Cameron, back before the 2010 election. And it seemed logical, therefore, to see if I could do something like the same job on the Labour Party. Obviously, there are differences between the two, because the Conservative Party have been out of power much longer, and in some senses, you could argue, was more desperate and more willing to make big changes in order to ensure that it had the best chance in 2010. Having said that, of course, the Labour Party under Ed Miliband has faced a huge obstacle in that it lost very badly in 2010, you know, down to 29% of the vote. And it's extremely unusual for a political party to be able to come back in just 5 years' time. So what the book really looks at is how a party and how a leader helps his party, or sometimes hinders his party, from doing that. And I guess if there's a central message, it's actually that politics is full of trade-offs, and leading a party is full of trade-offs. And while there are a lot of armchair generals, or Monday morning quarterbacks, as the Americans would say, who say, he should have done this, he could have done this, his brother would have done X, whereas he's done Y. Actually, politicians are fairly constrained in what they can do, because once they do one thing, they shut off other options. And so a lot of leading a political party, particularly over 5 years, and I think the Fixed Term Parliament Act has been quite interesting in this respect, is trying to keep a certain amount of flexibility. And there's a trade-off between doing that on the one hand and getting a very clear message. There's also a trade-off between keeping your party united, something that you mentioned earlier, and a very clear, punchy message that you start communicating to people, you know, very early on, so that by the time the election comes around, they're absolutely sure what you stand for. So Ed Miliband, I think, has sometimes had to compromise in that respect. He's kept the party together. Really, really important, because Labour's always fallen apart, you know, in the 50s, the 70s to some extent, and of course the 1980s. And that hasn't happened this time around. And Ed Miliband has something to do with that. It's not all down to him, but I think that has something to do with his management and also some of the kind of policy compromises he's made.
He's often compared to his brother, as we might expect, given the closeness of that race. There's been some polling out recently that says, you know, David Miliband would be like the preferred leader, maybe, if Ed wasn't there, or might be doing, in the past we've seen polls saying he might be doing a better job. I mean, that feels to me a little bit unfair, because, you know, to what extent can we really know that? I mean, what's your take on some of that polling?
Well, I mean, we can't really know that. And when people are asked that, I think it's just a top of head answer that most people, or at least large numbers of people, will give. We probably know that David Miliband would have perhaps taken a rather harsher view, perhaps, of what Labour did between, say, 2005, 2010, in terms of not reining in spending when the times were good. I think he might perhaps have conceded that Labour made a few more mistakes during that time. And I think perhaps in so doing, he would have been able to reclaim some of the achievements that had been made since 1997. And I think one of the problems perhaps that Ed Miliband has had comes from the fact that he was so keen to distance himself from the Blair era, if not the Brown era, during the leadership campaign, that it's actually made it very difficult for Labour then to reach back into the sort of 1997 to 2010 period. And actually,
which was a successful period, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And remind the public of that case. And what's happened is, of course, that the Conservatives very effectively have managed to rewrite history and suggest that that whole period was some spendthrift nightmare that they rescued the country from in 2010. And I think that kind of that aspect of the new Labour legacy has been difficult for Ed Miliband. It might have been slightly less difficult for his brother. But on the other hand, of course, within the Labour Party, there are a lot of people who wanted to distance themselves from Blair. And that's one of the big reasons why David Miliband didn't win the contest.
I suppose if we can look at David Cameron maybe as a sort of comparison here, where someone that went through this modernising agenda with the Conservative Party and then had to sort of sharply abandon it when he lost his base, or has lost a large amount of his base, to UKIP. So I suppose a counter-argument to David Miliband could be that actually he might have been more centrist, to use a phrase, more New Labour in terms of how he attacked the leadership. But he may have also lost a lot of votes to maybe the Greens or someone like that because of that.
I think that is an interesting argument. And even under Ed Miliband, who some people would say, you know, is a pretty left-wing or at least centre-left leader of the Labour Party, that seems to have happened. Although recent polling suggests that actually the Greens are beginning to fall away a little bit. Mm. I don't know if that's anything to do with Natalie Bennett or not. And I think you're right to say that under a more self-consciously centrist or Blairite leader, perhaps, you know, at the flanks, some of those voters who came over to Labour straight away from the Lib Dems after the coalition was formed may have then drifted off to the Greens. Mm. And, you know, perhaps that's happened less than it might have done under Ed Miliband.
We can't get away from the fact, of course, that his poll ratings are pretty bad. I mean, I'll read out some. There's a recent Comres poll for the Daily Mail where David Cameron has a very large lead, 49-33, in terms of who would make the best Prime Minister. We've got one in four, one in five Labour voters even saying that David Cameron would make the best Prime Minister. Surveyson have 42% versus 28% saying that they think David Cameron will be the Prime Minister after the election, maybe the nuances of the electoral system, you know, notwithstanding. And then to quote Comrades again, they do this favourability index where you look at the favourability ratings of parties and leaders, and the Labour Party has a much stronger rating than Ed Miliband. So when you put that all together, it doesn't paint a very good picture. I mean, do you have any sense from your investigations as to why you think that might be? He doesn't seem to cut across very well with the public, does he?
No, he doesn't. And I mean, that's been a problem from the very start. These ratings were never good, actually, to begin with. I mean, he started off in just about positive territory and then drifted down very, very quickly. And I think it is the case that very often first impressions count. And it's very difficult once those impressions have been given to actually change people's minds. If you look in contrast at, say, David Cameron, or I suppose Tony Blair is the kind of axiomatic example, if you start out strong, even if you begin to, you know, drift away towards polling day, which happened even to Blair and the Labour Party, to be honest, you've got further to fall from. And David Cameron came out with a very, very strong start. Deliberately, I think, decided that he was going to have a very strong visual start to his leadership. And that's something that Ed Miliband rejected. He thinks that kind of thing is superficial and gimmicky. So Ed Miliband didn't start out strong. I think that's been his problem, really. And once that happens, it's really, really hard to turn things around.
Mm. He's often, I mean, one of the things we were talking about before we hit record, and one of the things I find quite interesting is the kind of the open-ended question when you ask people in polls, you know, what are the first two or three words that come to mind when you think of leader X or, you know, leader Y? And with Ed Miliband, it's quite interesting because you tend to get two that dominate. Weird, and weak. And maybe we'll leave weird to other people. I mean, that's a very subjective thing, I guess. Clearly his opponents have been able to make that stick to an extent. But weak's quite interesting, isn't it? Because it seems to me the Conservatives want to paint him in almost two contradictory lights. One is the guy that knifed his brother, which doesn't sound very weak at all. And the other one is this kind of like flip-flopper who's like caves into the union. So where do you stand? I mean, presumably weak doesn't feel right.
Well, weak doesn't seem right when you consider some of the stands that he's made, both in terms of society more generally and in terms of the Labour Party internally. So if we take the first one, I mean, clearly his standing up, if you like, to Rupert Murdoch and News International, you couldn't really regard that as the act of a weak person. The fact that he's been prepared to rightly or wrongly criticise some businesses, you know, for being predators rather than producers, that's not a particularly weak thing to do. And then if you look at the second aspect, the internal aspect, this is someone who put an end to the convention that the PLP elected the shadow cabinet so that he could choose his own team, something that Blair didn't do in opposition. And of course, although it wasn't necessarily planned, has gone a long way to removing the role of the trade union, certainly in choosing the leader, if not actually...
Ironic, perhaps, considering how he was elected.
Yes, absolutely. But in some ways, perhaps that's that meant that he was the only person who could really do that. So I think weakness is actually more to do with the effectiveness of the Conservative attack, because it seems very similar to what they were able to do to Neil Kinnock, who, after all, again, apart from possibly, you know, during the miners' strike where he had to compromise a little bit on that, was not a weak leader of the Labour Party. I mean, you know, transformed the Labour Party, modernised the Labour Party, prepared the ground for Tony Blair, took on Militant, dumped Union National and Nuclear Disarmament, did all sorts of things, and yet the Tory attack on Kinnock was very, very similar. He was weak.
Although I suppose one area where, well, it'd be interesting to get your thoughts, one area where Ed Miliband could be criticised is Scotland. I suppose there's two interpretations of this. It does look like the Labour Party is going to lose the vast bulk of its seats in Scotland. There's different interpretations of how bad that might be. And I think actually a lot of the SNP vote is coming from previously people that didn't vote. So it'd be interesting to see if they do actually turn up. How much do we blame Ed Miliband for that? Because it's quite, I suppose, on the one hand, the furore over Scottish independence happens regardless. But on the other hand, it is interesting to have a leader that in some polls performs worse than David Cameron in Scotland, and therefore can't really go up there and sort of make the case for the union and make the case for a Labour government himself very overtly. So, I mean, do we think he deserves criticism for what's going on in Scotland?
Well, I think the Labour Party leadership as a whole probably deserves criticism for the way that they were completely wrong-footed by David Cameron on the day after the referendum. Because it really was quite amazing how they weren't prepared for David Cameron to immediately come on to the steps of Downing Street and not do the statesman-like thing, but actually play the whole thing for party advantage, which I think helped alienate Scottish opinion even further. I'm not so sure, however, that apart from the fact that obviously his ratings in Scotland are certainly no better than they are in England, you can actually blame Ed Miliband for what's happened after the referendum, in the sense that it seems that a lot of people who voted for independence actually got the bug, if you like, the SNP bug, and are now determined to take their support for independence into support for the SNP at the next election, in the hope that the SNP will be able to get an even better deal for Scotland and perhaps in the end, trigger another referendum. I think as well you'd have to say that Labour suffered from the fact that its machine in Scotland was a little bit tired, a little bit old, a little bit rusty, and also from a campaign which was effective in terms of winning the referendum campaign that was actually quite negative and didn't really give people a positive reason to vote Labour. And I think that's then impacted on Labour's position in Scotland after the referendum.
I suppose the electoral system comes into play here too. I mean, John Curtis was on this podcast many episodes ago now and said that, look, 45% loses you a referendum, 45% gives you a landslide in a parliamentary
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it is a fascinating aspect of...
They're quite close, aren't they, the 45... It's not identical, but
no. It's, I mean, it's a fascinating aspect of the electoral system in that, you know, it's always presumed to work to the detriment of small parties, unless of course they are spatially concentrated, and that's absolutely why the SNP is going to be able to convert its support into large numbers of seats, and I think it will be extremely difficult for Labour to pull much back. And actually, there's a very interesting aspect of this for Labour's campaign, because of course one of the people who is central to the UK campaign is Douglas Alexander. What does he do now? Because it looks as if, like many Labour MPs, he's going to be in trouble in Scotland. Is he going to cut his losses and face the fact that he's not going to be able to defend that seat and so devote more of his time to the UK campaign? Or is he going to somehow try and fight a rearguard action which will take him out of London and therefore out of the loop? And that makes me think back to 1992. And older listeners might remember Chris Patten, the Tory chairman, had that exact same dilemma. What did he do? And in the end, he had to sacrifice his seat in Bath for the greater good, as it were, of the party. It paid off for the Tories in 1992. Yep. Who knows, it could pay off for the Labour Party in 2015.
Be interesting, certainly. I guess one of the interesting things about Ed Miliband's ratings is the extent to which they matter. I mean, we look... For a long time, people have said, this Tory crossover, as they call it, is coming. The Tories are going to pull ahead. It looks like they might do a few weeks back, but then suddenly the parties are neck and neck again. I mean, there's an interesting question that's coming from Adam Drummond from Opinion on social media, on Twitter, asking about whether or not Ed Miliband's ratings are priced in. And this is an area I'm interested in too. The idea being that, as we get closer to election day, will these bad poll ratings pull down the Labour vote share? Or actually... is the Labour vote share almost taking into account the fact, I don't necessarily like Ed Miliband, but frankly, I prefer a Labour government to a Conservative one? I mean, to an extent, we don't necessarily know, and I suppose that's going to be regionalised and nuanced everywhere, but what's your sort of take on that?
Well, actually, I mean, there's a debate among political scientists that, believe it or not, is still raging as to whether party leaders make that much difference in parliamentary systems, including, of course, the UK. So I think if you were to, ask, is there a consensus at the moment, it is that, yes, they probably do, but it's nowhere near as much as many journalists, for example, would think. And that we still are in a system where, for the most part, people are voting for parties. And obviously, leader images feed into that vote, but they're only part of the party brand. It's not yet, anyway, such a presidentialised contest that a leader... is less popular than the leader of another party can't still win an election. Obviously, we're living in very different times to 1945, where someone as charismatic as Clement Attlee was able to beat this war hero Churchill. And we're probably living in different times even to 1979, where Mrs. Thatcher was able to beat Jim Callaghan, even though she was some way behind him in the polls. But I still don't think we've got to the point yet where someone who is less popular than his main rival is going to be unable to win this election. Although, of course, when we use the word win, we're probably not talking about an overall majority. We're simply talking about whether he can come just above the Conservatives or just behind the Conservatives, giving Labour a chance of forming some kind of coalition or a minority government. So I think it's still possible. As to whether it's been priced in, that's a really, really difficult one, because it could go one of two ways. Most people, of course, are tuned out of politics for most of the parliament, and only really tune in towards the election and the election
maybe
day.
Maybe when it's a by-election or a budget.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. So for those people, their impression of Ed Miliband will be indirect, and will be what they read and hear about from other people, which is he's weak, he's weird, he's not very good. Now, during their campaign, when those people see more of Ed Miliband, particularly maybe in a debate situation, this is clearly what Labour is thinking, he won't actually be as bad as they've heard he is. And that will mean that possibly he becomes less of a liability. I'm not going to say an asset to Labour's poll rating. On the other hand, as you suggest, it's possible that people have already got a poor impression of him. That impression is going to be reinforced rather than shaken off. So it's a really, really difficult question, that. I think it's an interesting one, but I don't think it's something that we can actually answer.
And I suppose, I mean, one of the things you've got to look at is where the Labour votes are coming from in terms of where the 2010 votes are coming from. And a lot of them are Liberal Democrat switchers, aren't they? Perhaps you might imagine sort of left-leaning Lib Dems who are unhappy about what's been done in government. So I suppose the idea that they're going to suddenly vote Conservative because they don't like Ed Miliband is probably quite unlikely, isn't it?
Yes, and I think the other thing to say, and this clearly comes out of the British election study data, you know, these huge panel studies, is that while Cameron's ratings are undoubtedly better than Ed Miliband's, they are by no means stellar. We are not talking here about one potential prime minister who is absolutely useless playing against another current prime minister who is absolutely brilliant. We're talking about, you know, the leader of the opposition who certainly could be better playing against a prime minister who really isn't that much to write home about as far as most voters are concerned, albeit, you know, has quite good communication skills. But sometimes, actually, the flip side of that, of course, he's seen as too smooth and too much of a PR man.
Well, and one of the things that's almost ignored is he's lost large amounts of his base to UKIP, hasn't he? You know, and UKIP is a more complicated thing than simply being the Conservative right, but a large amount of it is.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And Cameron, of course, has been pulled, you know, every which way, really, by that dilemma. And he's certainly abandoned the modernisation project that he started his leadership with. And that's a problem, because if we look at where the Tories over the last, you know, couple of decades have lost their support, it's actually not necessarily among the fabled C2 voters. It's among kind of well-heeled, well-educated, sometimes public sector, but not always middle-class people. And that's what the modernisation project was actually designed to do something about, as well as perhaps begin to attract ethnic minorities, which is a long-term problem for the Conservative Party. And certainly what David Cameron has done since he's been in government is not going to get many of those people back. So the Conservatives have got problems of their own, which is why Ed Miliband, even though he's not the most impressive leader of the opposition that anyone's ever seen in this country, still stands a reasonable chance anyway of becoming prime minister.
I mean, looking at let's look ahead at what might happen. I mean, I know obviously it's very difficult to know. It seems quite likely there's going to be a hung parliament, doesn't it? That seems to be what the consensus is, unless the opinion polls are dramatically out in a sort of 1992 fashion. I'm quite curious as to what you think Ed Miliband does. I mean, there's a question that's come in from Harry Agard Evans. Harry, hopefully I've pronounced the second part of that correctly, from Ipsos Mori, about, you know, well, he asks specifically about, does Ed Miliband step down if the Conservatives form a government despite Labour having most seats? I mean, let's just say, change that a little bit. I mean, are there circumstances you think that Ed Miliband carries on as Labour leader, even if, beyond the caretaker role that, you know, sometimes they play, even if David Cameron remains Prime Minister?
I think that would be very, very hard to envisage, to be honest. I think the only possibility in which that could occur would be if people thought that there might be a second election within weeks, in which case I think Labour might stick with him. But barring that, I really can't see Ed Miliband having another go, no.
Because this sort of comes back to the whole fixed-term Parliament Act, which is a question that's coming from David as well. You know, perhaps one of the most unforeseen things that might be happening is that there could be a minority government of one colour or another, but actually struggles to carry on. But no one seems to know for sure what the implications of the Fixed Term Parliament Act are for that.
No, I mean, some people would argue that there is this passage in the Fixed Term Parliament Act that actually makes it very, very difficult to secure the kind of vote of no confidence that will automatically, in some ways, trigger an election. I think, actually, that, of course, Parliament can't be bound by anything it's previously done. If it really were necessary to rewrite the law in order to make what most politicians want to happen, then that would occur. I don't actually foresee that happening. I can see that technically it's possible to argue in some circumstances it will be difficult to obtain a dissolution, but I just can't see, actually, you know, de facto, that being much of a problem. I think the whole question of minority government, however, is incredibly interesting, because
are we underestimating how, you know, bad that could be?
No, I mean, I don't think so. I mean, if before we get into how bad it could be, I mean, I think we need to discuss a little bit about, you know, who might be in the box seat after May the 8th. And there is, I think, an attempt on the part of some Conservative commentators and some people in the Conservative Party to suggest that somehow if Labour come behind the Tories, not just in terms of vote share, which is possible, but even in terms of seat share, that it will be somehow illegitimate for Labour to form a government rather than the Conservatives.
You know, difficult for them, though, in that situation.
Difficult for them, but actually, if you look at the numbers and you look at the other parties in Parliament, it's perfectly possible to foresee circumstances in which Ed Miliband is able to get a deal with those other parties for confidence and supply that David Cameron isn't able to get. So it's perfectly possible, and I should stress perfectly constitutionally proper, for a Labour Party that finishes, say, on 285 seats and to actually form a government, even though the Conservative Party finishes ahead of it on 290 seats. Because in the end, it's who you can get to back you on a vote and the Queen's speech, you know. And if Miliband can do that, and it doesn't look as though David Cameron is able to do that, then ironically enough, it will be David Cameron who has to go and advise the palace that they should invite Ed Miliband to form a government. So, I mean, it will be fascinating, will be absolutely fascinating. And then, of course, there's the question of minority government itself. I suspect that could be more stable than people think, because if you look around other parts of Europe and other parts of the world, we're increasingly moving towards what, you know, in the jargon is called contract parliamentarianism, whereby people do written agreements. They're not coalition agreements, but they're agreements for confidence and supply, so that you're not continually thinking that, you know, the next day might bring a confidence vote which might bring you down. And I think that would be the way that we would go. I'm taking example from the Nordic countries and New Zealand, where this is very common.
And presumably that feels like most likely to happen under a Labour minority government rather than the Conservative one. Because, I mean, it feels like the Conservatives, given the lack of friends they're likely to have in Parliament, need to be much, much closer to that 3-2-6 or whatever the real figure is.
Yes, but there is one permutation that people often forget about when it comes to this. And that is a large number of minority governments in Europe and elsewhere aren't simply one-party minority governments. They're minority coalitions. And it's perfectly possible to envisage the Conservatives maybe even getting together with either the DUP and or the Liberal Democrats to get them somewhere near, you know, that 3-2-3, 3-2-5. We'll get them, you know, quite close, and actually would allow them to form a government which can probably go on an issue-by-issue basis reasonably stably, but we'll have to see about that. There are more permutations, put it this way, than people think. But I do agree with your basic premise, which is the Conservatives certainly don't have as many options as Labour, given what the SNP have actually said. And in some ways, it's the tragedy of the Conservative Party that it's not a firm believer in proportional representation because of the first past the post system we have in this country. Large numbers of people can vote for UKIP without actually getting many UKIP MPs into Parliament. And that therefore denies the Conservatives a natural support and confidence party, or indeed a coalition partner. So the Conservatives, while we operate under first past the post, and while UKIP might get 10, you know, who knows, 15%, they're never going to have enough allies on their right flank to do the kind of deal that Conservative and centre-right parties do in Europe all the time.